going to be looking into the fact of death and the Sufi teachings on this fact. Just play a short piece of music when we start by Sam Baker. I don't know if you know Sam Baker. I first heard about him in an interview on Fresh Air. He was talking to Terry Gross about this. What, 2 o'clock?
Oh,
not quite 2? It's a really good interview if you want to go back to the archives of Fresh Air and hear the interview with Sam Baker. He was a fairly young guy, very athletic and going on adventures, and he was in Peru on a train, and there a terrorist bomb went off in the train compartment and blew the whole thing to smithereens, and it was very devastating. He saw people die around him. He was deeply injured and took years to recover. He still doesn't have all of his sound and lost some fingers. But during that whole process of the shattering the bomb and then being in the hospital and maybe not making it, he went through these inner experiences where an inner light opened up. And he refrains from, you know, making it too metaphysical about what everything means, but his experience was altered, totally altered, and he felt that he had the message or the inspiration, the visitation that from the light to... Did something happen to you?
Surgery.
To not, to come, you know, really come into earth, to stay here. And there was a message he had to give. And he was, by his own admission, a pretty bad musician, writing stupid songs and adolescent songs and singing in a bar and stuff. But he started writing his songs and singing, and he's a really gritty kind of cowboy guy. I could go on and listen to his music, something really compelling. But I tend to like the music and the poems and the words that people who've gone through a lot have to say about life, and what they say doesn't come cheaply. So. Here's Sam Baker, as we're going into the death realms.
Go in peace, go in kindness, go in love, go in faith. Leave the day behind us, day is done, go in grace. Let us go into the dark, not afraid, not alone, let us hope. Some good pleasure takes you to arrive at home. Let us hope by some good pleasure takes you to arrive at home.
So we won't say the invocation formally, but in this moment of beginning, let's together do what we need to do inside to make our hearts and minds receptive, to take in whatever teaching that's given in a way that fits us and is useful and digestible and helpful. Part of that could mean for a moment clearing aside our notions of how things are, to make maybe some room. And then it's also stronger if we unite in our receptivity, like an open chalice together. So we feel the room, the sincerity of pondering the questions of life. So let's feel our group feel to the degree that we can. We're so often kind of led into some kind of private interior place. So this is kind of like opening our skin out this way. Right through the walls, into the trees, and 360 with the creatures. Okay. So I apologize in advance to those of you who are my students who have heard this story 10,000 times. You never know at which time it's going to go, oh, I get it. The prince and the horse. Okay, you know how we can get into that place of just listening to a story and just kind of opening to it. So that's the place from which this teaching comes. It's from a book, Wake Up to Your Life, by Ken MacLeod. I asked him, where did this come from? Because I wanted to share it. And he said, I don't know, my teacher just told it at some point. In a faraway country, now lost in the midst of time, there lived an old king and queen. Their son, a young prince, though proficient in matters of war and clever enough in affairs of state, showed little interest in the responsibilities that would come his way one day. And as the king was old and his health was failing, the queen was increasingly worried about her son and the way he conducted his life. Not knowing what to do, she visited a sorcerer and explained her concerns. The sorcerer listened in silence and then said, well, what does he like most of all? Horses, said the queen. He's passionate about horses. That's all he really cares about. Well, that will do, said the magician. And he told the queen to walk into the palace gardens the following afternoon. The next day after lunch, the queen asked the prince and the court retinue to stroll with her in the palace gardens. Just outside the palace gate at the end of the garden stood a beautiful white horse. An old man held the reins. The prince ran to the horse, examined it for a moment, and turned to the old man. I have to have this horse. It's a magnificent animal. How much do you want for it? The old man bowed and said, oh, not so fast, not so fast. You're a prince. I'd be foolish to sell you this horse before you ride it. Are there any chairs back there? There's one up here in front. Okay. This is a story about the prince and the horse. Please. Don't think about it, just relax. Reading the story about a prince and a horse. Perfect. The prince, the queen was worried about the prince because he wasn't taking his responsibilities, and so she called a sorcerer, and that's right where we are. Okay, so he's the prince sees the animal, says, how much is it? Wait, says, don't, not so fast, you're a prince. It would be foolish to sell you this horse before you ride it. Mount up. If you still want it when you come back, we can discuss the price. Well, the prince needed no urging. He quickly mounted the horse. The moment he was in the saddle, the horse began to gallop. Oh, how the horse could gallop. Faster and faster, they raced through the town and out into the surrounding farmlands. The prince was thrilled. He'd never ridden such a swift and powerful beast. They galloped across the countryside into the hills and high over the mountains, over the passes, and into the next kingdom. The horse never tired. They galloped far behind any villages and towns, into regions the prince didn't even know. Finally, as the sun began to set, the horse slowed to a walk and stopped in the middle of a deep forest. The prince looked around. He had no idea where he was. He dismounted and led the horse along the path. Evening was coming, and the prince was a little worried. But he saw a light in the distance, and he went toward it. The light came from a small cottage. He knocked on the door, and a beautiful young woman opened it. The prince explained his plight, but she had never heard of his kingdom. Still, night had fallen, so she invited the prince in and introduced him to her father, an old man who worked as a woodcutter. The prince stayed the night and set out the next morning to find his way home. He traveled as far as he could and asked every person he met about his home kingdom. But no one knew anything about it. Nobody could help him find his way. Each night, the prince returned to the woodcutter and his daughter. And eventually, he began to help the old man with his work. He learned how to cut wood, grew wise in the ways of the forest. The prince was increasingly attracted to the daughter, and she to him, so they married. The prince settled down into his new life and his new trade. Occasionally, when he saw the horse by the house, the prince remembered how he had come there. But he didn't dwell on that matter long. Like us, we're dwelling on it when we come to Sufi camp. What is all this? How did we come to be here? In time, his wife gave birth to a son and a daughter. His life was full. The old man retired, and the prince took over the business. He cut wood, he stacked it, he took it to the market. The income wasn't much, but it took care of their needs, and as they had few other cares, they lived happily and peacefully. The memories of his former life as a prince faded away. The prince often walked far into the forest. On one of his walks, he came to a glen that he had not seen before. In the glen was a pond with water so clear and still that you could see all the way to the bottom. The glen, the pond, and the still clear water drew him for reasons he didn't understand. He often went to the glen where he would sit, looking into the still depth of the pond. One day while he sat by the pond, he heard a cry. His two children came running out of the forest. A tiger was chasing them. He'd never seen a tiger in the forest before. The prince jumped up to protect his children, but before he could do anything, his children ran into the pond and disappeared. The tiger jumped in and disappeared as well. His wife came running up and ran in after them. She too disappeared. The old man came hobbling along and following the others, disappeared into the water. At that moment, the prince's horse galloped up, leaped into the center of the pond, and disappeared. The waters of the pond became still again, clear again, but no traces of his family, or his horse, or the tiger were to be seen. The prince was dumbfounded. What happened? In a space of 2 minutes, everything in his life had vanished. Unable to take in what had happened, he continued to look into the water, perhaps hoping to see something. When the shock of his loss finally hit him, he fell to the ground, his body shaking with sobs, and he cried and cried. And he felt a hand then softly touching his shoulder. The prince looked up. Above him were the eyes of his mother, the queen, and around him were the concerned faces of the courtiers. The palace gardens, the horse was standing quietly. The queen was relieved. She told him that as soon as he touched the horse, he had fallen to the ground. He'd been lying there in a trance for 2 or 3 minutes. "No," said the prince, "not 2 or 3 minutes. Years. I had a life. I had a family, a trade, people I loved, a wife, children. I had things that mattered to me. I lived my whole life. It wasn't 2 or 3 minutes. That isn't possible." Dazed and bewildered, he stood and walked away. The old man bowed to the queen, took the horse and left. The prince was profoundly moved by this mystery, and his attitude changed. His heart opened to every moment of his life. After his father died, the prince ruled wisely and well, fully present and attentive to the concerns of his people and the welfare of his kingdom. Imagine what it would be like to suddenly, this moment, wake up to the startling realization that this is all a dream. Just like we wake up in the morning in our bed. Ooh, we wake up and we see our stuff around. Oh, that was a dream. Well, what if we wake up from this and see, oh, ooh. I thought this was real life. This is a solid thing. This is solid. This is life. But in a minute, it's a dream of form, a dream with certain time-space matrices, but a dream to the soul, from the soul's perspective. And from inside this dream matrix form world, we are conditioned to the solidity of it all. The solidity of it all. But we cannot forever deny the fact of death. Death puts an end to this life as we know it. Right? It says something about this life. It points to something about this life. If we keep not taking it in, if we keep denying the fact of death, we dream on in a certain way. It's not that it's bad, but it's incomplete. If we deny the most basic thing, that this, which Merson calls the apparent condition, is 2 minutes long compared to eternity, like a prince. And we continue to act as if and think as if and behave as if this is just going to go on forever, even though like our mind says, no, it's not. But getting it like in our gut, that changes everything. That is total game changer for living. Because a perspective that opens when we actually feel the reality of things ending, the change is always happening. Everything is changing, nothing stays the same, except the one changeless aspect of our being, which is our soul, which is unborn and undying, so therefore it doesn't change. But to viscerally get the truth of ending, change, and the having to give up the notion that we can actually control this things. That's a huge, big deal for our mind. The mind cannot get this. Something else in us has to get this. It's not, our mind is not capable of getting that we end. So this leads to the importance of awakening to our soul, because our soul is what knows the changeless. Our soul is what knows the unborn. So a lot of spiritual practice and teaching is about coming to terms with, grappling with, getting, eating, tasting the truth of what this life ends. And it's, we're here for in this form, in this way, for a certain amount of time. So one of my favorite lines from a Japanese poet is, I knew in meeting you, we would have to part. Okay? So there's the first part. There's the understanding. But we don't want that understanding. So we deny that. Because if we eat that, we take that in, that's like, it's depressing. It's like, we don't like it. And the second part of it is, I knew in meeting we would have to part. Yet I ignored the coming dawn and gave myself to you. So let's consider in kind of a personal way before I read some of Merchant's teachings on death. Let's consider in our own life. The actual visceral significance of everything changes, nothing stays the same. And yet, because if we can start to actually feel that terrain of change, there's a possibility of loosening our grip on trying to keep things solid and unchanging. So it's a productive inquiry. When I think of moments in my own life, or when somebody I was close to, I witnessed a moment when this realization occurred, this flash. Right? One was with my brother. He told me about, my brother was a Marine in Vietnam, and he was in battle. And I can't remember the name of the place in Vietnam where this huge battle took place, but it was awful. And he survived, and he's pretty okay. And his niece, his wife's daughter, it was in college. This was maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And they were going to Vietnam for a college trip. And as it turned out, they went to this place where this battle happened, because now the Vietnamese and the Americans are friendly, and there's a school there for children, and there's some vets working there. And his niece and her classmates were on the port tow, smiling with the village people. And my brother saw that picture, and it was like, it's not possible. I have a whole reality inside my mind what this place is. And here is this picture of how it is now. This doesn't fit. And yet, that's change. And that was one of the most important, I think, things in my brother's healing, or let's say coming into some kind of relative wholeness of spirit, to take that in, that his story changes. That's a major shift, like an aha. I had a few other examples. Oh, one is this is slightly different, but it's coming to terms with something. It's my father. Was one of those very, very intense litigators, and was used to wielding power with very little resistance or being defeated. Like one of those people that can go through life kind of like getting their way and not having to submit. And later in his 80s, he had pancreatic cancer, and he tried every single thing there was to do, like going to extreme measures until it was clear, I can't beat this. There's a wall, there's a no. The world that he knew was gone. This is a new world. I can't beat this. What's this world not like? Oh, one more. I have one more example. In case the point isn't being made. It's from Pir Vilayat. God bless his soul. Coming from my generation, coming from the Midwest, not having lived through a war, I mean, my father was in World War II, and Pir Vilayat was in World War II. So these were always just, stories that were outside of my own experience. And for those of you who don't know, Hazranet Khan, Pirzia's grandfather, Hazranet Khan lived in Fazl Manzil with the family and the four children, Nirnisa and the Marids, The Oriental Room is where they hold the sacred meditations, and Murshid laid the cornerstone for the universal. It's like the really our shrine in a way, Fossil Mansal. And Vilayat told me the story of, as the Germans were coming into Paris, you know, they had to flee on the motorcycle with his mother in the back and get to the border crossing. And the Nazis took over Fossil Mansal, and it became a Gestapo headquarters. And there were machine guns on the balcony. This stuff happens all the time. It's happening throughout the world, towns and cities. But we live in a protected environment. So, not to belabor this point that everything changes, nothing stays the same, but the most seemingly solid, the most sacred thing, the thing that we've built our life on, the thing we depend on, is going to change. What are we going to do about it? How should we address this? That's what the spiritual teachings are here for. This is a question of life. This is a life question. So who do we turn to find out answers, to find out what to do about the situation? So we're going to look at what Murshid has to say about this. We could say one, I would say, common feature teaching, at least in the spiritual paths that I've encountered, which is Buddhism and Christianity and Sufism, is that there is what would be called a groundless ground. A groundless ground that it reveals itself when the attachment to solidity and control and believing things stay the same and don't change, when those are loosened up, there is a possibility to see what is not that. A groundless ground, a ground that holds all things but has no form, is not solid. So I've chosen a few passages of Murshid to speak about, to bring this in, and then we'll continue tomorrow because it is directly connected to this, our soul, because our soul is the groundless ground. Our soul is that our soul is the aspect of ourself that is completely not different and one with the groundless ground, that which doesn't change, that which is not dependent on being born and dying. It's not dependent on form. It's of another dimension altogether. The soul has no beginning and no end. This is possible, to find this part of ourself. And that's why we say we're saved. Christ Jesus saved us through showing the eternal life. I'm going to make one thing, a little red flag over here, because we are talking this week about what survives death, and that we can find that in ourselves right now. This is why one of the Sufi mantras is "Muta kabla anta muta." Is that right? Muta. Yeah. Die before death. In other words, go through actually what it means to die. Well, we have to let go and have ourselves at physical deaths to arrive at this groundless ground, that we can do this now. That's the practice, to go through this in life. Then we live in the deathless realm. You see? Because the deathless realm is right here. It's what holds both life and death. But we're in the dream. It's a good dream. We wanted this dream. It's very good. But when we see beyond it, then this dream is even better. Because the sun is shining through it all. It's just like... Okay. These are just various kind of random quotes about Marcia to the point of this immortal, finding this immortal aspect of ourself. If the resurrection merely meant that Christ, after his death, rose again, it would be a story which could either be believed or disbelieved. Its lesson is much greater than that. It means the resurrection from this mortal life to immortality. Okay, so when we hear something like this, the resurrection of this mortal life to immortality, we think naturally like, okay, our bodies are gonna die, and then we will be, maybe, in this immortal life. But what he's saying is this message is, we carry our consciousness is cathected and embedded in a mortal framework, a mortal point of view, and that we can bust out of that, we can awaken out of that into the realization of that part of ourself which is immortal and is unborn and undying. Those who have risen to that immortal one are the sons and daughters of resurrection. The story tells that when Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to the tomb where Christ had been laid, they found that the stone that was laid before the tomb had been rolled away. And looking in, they saw his wrappings lying about and the head cloth in the place of its in a place by itself. But the body of Christ was not there. The stone is the same stone that is spoken of in the Hindu myths. The Lord Krishna is called Gurdwara, the one who holds the same stone. Oh, sorry, the one who lifts the stone up. Okay, so this is a universal story. Under this stone, every individual soul in the world is oppressed. It is the stone of the external self. And when this is lifted up, then we rise to immortality. And above what do we rise? We rise above the body, our consciousness embedded in body sensations, only believing that what is real is our sensations, and above the mind. We rise above experiencing existence through a mental framework. Man makes many mistakes, but there is one principal one, and that is that she goes through life thinking that she will stay here forever. That's what we were talking about in the beginning. That's, we have to break out of that. And since she is without preparation, the call naturally comes to her as a blow instead of as an invitation. When we think of the journey beyond, we begin to see how many there are in this world who do not even know there is a hereafter. And the one who believes in the hereafter already has preconceived notions about it, religious or philosophical. But this does not suffice. We must become acquainted with the road along which we have to pass and the road by which the soul descended to earth. This road is the bridge. The life which everyone knows in this momentary period is the soul's captivity. Beyond this apparent condition, we know nothing. Therefore, every seeming change that takes place, we call death or decay. And once the soul has risen above this illusory phase of life, by surmounting all that exists apart from itself, it experiences in the end that happiness for which the whole creation took place. So the uncovering of the soul. And just a few more and then we'll do some practices. In spiritual awakening, the first thing that comes to us is a lifting of the veil, and that means the lifting of the apparent condition. Okay, so we'll just take a pause here for a minute, see what's happening. Just notice, like, maybe how you're feeling about this whole situation. Do a little experiment for a moment. Think of somebody you're close to, maybe even feel a great deal of attachment to, that would be very difficult if you had to be separated from them. As we go, I'm trying it as I go. I was going along there, but I'm not sure. We'll try it. Can you feel the sense of my in that? Can you feel this like little tinge of ownership? Even with our house, even if we like totally own it, we're not just renting. And then we have some bit of knowledge, like some spiritual realization. Even if it's not that gross, like, oh, mine. If it's just like, yeah, it's mine. But there's that mine in it. That's what death does. It, like, takes that my away. Then everything just is. That's what we don't like. We want to be the owner. It's so hard to give that up. It's death. It's death. That's what dies. Giving up being the owner of things. The owner of our mate, the owner of what we like, the owner of our knowledge. Right? Isn't it? When you think about it? That's the problem. It's so hard for that I to die off. So it takes practice. So let's do a practice of that. Okay? Let's take our practice. I'll kind of explain the zikr that we're going to do, and then I'll put some music on and we can ease into it. Sarah, could you get me some more water, please? Thank you. Okay, we'll first start with just sensing. Thank you so much. Sensing breathing, that we're taking in a breath now. Thank you. Now, what is more common more ordinary than breathing. We've been doing it since we were born. We hardly pay any attention to it unless we're directly practicing it. But if we really double click on it right now, we see that if we did not, like for 10 or 15 minutes right now, if we did not have this breath that we're taking in, that would be the whole end of life in this dream plane. That's not a concept, that's not like a metaphysical point of view, that's something very direct. So feel that, but feel it, this breath I'm taking right now. I'm being given life, moment by moment, breath by breath. This is life. It's not like in the beginning of time. It's not conceptual. We have no idea where it came from, who's giving it to us. Let's just say the giver of breath is giving us breath. That's amazing. And look what we have because we're given this breath. We're having this experience together. And we've had this whole life, like the prince. Everything that's happened to us from the moment we were born, for better or for worse, such as it was, the mistakes, the glory, the failings, the experiments, all, this whole life. That's amazing. It's almost like a book, the book of our life. With breath by breath by breath. Being given breath, being given breath, being given life, our life. And look at all that's happened. So this is what we're gonna do in the circuit. We're gonna actually, when we do the swing with our hand, with our body, we're gonna contemplate this whole unfoldment of our breath by breath life. All these little things that we wouldn't even think were significant. You know, the atmosphere of the house we grew up in, getting called to the principal's office, like being nervous on our first date, and our first, like, seeing suffering, and everything that's happened. This is the life that has been given to us by the giver of breath. It was given to us when we were born, and it will disappear into the great spirit in our last exhalation. But for now, this book of our life is our breath by breath existence. So when we go like this, we're feeling our unprecedented, unique in this vast universe, this special, unique life, such as it is. It's not like for like judging it or evaluating. That's like so minor compared to having a life and living it. It's so like stupidly unimportant. It's that we have had this life and we're having it now. So that's on that. And then when we can come down, let's offer it, this life, to the giver of breath. We've been given the breath of life. We've been given life. It's like incredibly intimate. And we come back up, just in that intimacy, in that communion of, and then do the whole thing again, just keep cycling through it. And I'll put some music on in the background. So we're not gonna say la ilaha illallahu. We're just gonna do the motion, if you like, which is the swing of the torso. But the inner meaning is feeling our whole life if you want to kind of just go through, actually envision it from, you know, infancy up through the decades, fine. If you want to just feel the meaning of it, but just really the most important thing is to feel your life as you, the gift of your life. And then the bow, and we'll all be doing it in our own rhythm, so we don't have to like do it as a group. Bow, and that, and that's that feeling. At a certain point, it is given back. At the end of this life, it is like returned. Might also come up a feeling of returning and giving back to the one owner of all experiences, of all the experiences of the have, all the beauty. And we can just sit in this space together. As we learn to practice and slowly relinquish ownership, we see then that everything is free, freely given. It's all free. We have everything. We can enjoy everything. We don't have to own it. That's the beginning of the kind of the discovery of the soul. Okay, that's all I have to say, and it's like before the time is up, so. Would anybody like to share anything or say anything? Yes. What is your name?
This question is bugging me right now.
I'm sorry, I'm not very good at hearing. Could you speak up?
I said this question is bugging me a lot, and it's probably a defensive process on my part of avoiding things. But Pierre Zia said this morning something. I'm not sure exactly the words he used, but something like the soul wasn't activated or started or something until you started using language. So when we think of the soul as being the thing that never changes, how do you understand that in relationship to the fact that something happens before and after you have language?
I guess what I would, that what all that strikes me is that which doesn't change was activated in human experience. There was a, you know, there was a docking or a kind of a further connection to this world of form.
So the soul is somehow different then?
The soul is never different, never changes. Doesn't go or come.
So what happens with this language activation part?
Why do you ask Pierre Zia?
I think you're talking about disincarnation.
Yeah. Okay, those of you who know the answer,
soul is part of that, as the active and unchanging part. So it's the
incarnation.
The soul fully incarnates when the child begins to speak his words.
Good question. Glad you asked it. Amina.
I had this experience just a few months ago where...
Can you hear Amina in the back?
I had this experience a few months ago where my beloved was taken ill quite suddenly, quite substantially.
People would like to hear you. Do you mind?
No, thank you. Thank you.
Should I start again?
Yes,
yeah.
Please.
So my beloved was taken ill in January, quite unexpectedly and quite dramatically. So a panic sets up, and I was watching my breathing, which got more shallow as watching him go through this. The details of the illness don't matter, but everything they tried kept not working. My breath got more shallow, and the more that this didn't work, I found myself almost losing my breath. But this wonderful being that was helping care for him, his name was Isaiah, and he came over to me and he said, you know, you really have to breathe through this, and you're breathing through it for him and yourself. And then he said, then you have to get with him and get him to use his strength to come back. So I started doing that. This would be a story in and of itself. But then what they gave him to help him live, then they really killed him. So we went through the whole thing all over again, back to the hospital the next few days. And it was a perfect opportunity to be in this difficult wrangling, like Jacob and the archangel, you know. And you speaking to this today has caused me to recall that when I was doing the Zikr, I was in that process and recognizing the going through of it is a piece, a little piece of that. Dying before death.
Right.
And so I appreciate that. Being brought back to my heart.
Thank you. Thank you.
I forgot to say he's fine now.
Well, my husband did die in October, and he was very sick for a short time, but at the moment of death, he opened his eyes, which had been closed a long time, and had the most beatific smile. And doing the sicker, I just kind of kept thinking, I borrowed this life, thank you. And it made me very joyful. I mean, I kind of cling to myself and my identity and everything in the world. But doing this exercise, I just felt like, thank you for giving me this. Here, you can have it back. And I just felt like the little smile.
Thank you. Kathleen? You have a big voice.
It's just a
speak from there.
Just a quote from the Quran, speaking to the soul after having lived, saying, O soul, return to your Lord, pleased and well-pleasing.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the experience with that zikr of, as Taj suggested, to collect my life and kind of sweep it all up. And then in the bowing part of the zikr, I felt that I was making an offering, that my life was my offering to the Lord. And it just felt so well, it felt sad, but it also feels so, I feel such a profound responsibility about making a life that's worth offering.
I know you have.
I've had pain of my own, so I know it exists, and it's a real decision fee for that process, but I never know what to do when I'm faced with it, other than to be present to it. Because many people, they're very happy to do it. They complete all of everything, and they've decided that they do not want that experience, and they're going to do this,
yeah,
and they're completely okay about it, but I'm just wondering what happens on, it's physician-assisted suicide, and it's a choice that people have. The people of both states have voted that people would have that choice to make, and some do, some of them get medicine and never do it, but do you have...
No. No, I'm sorry, I just, these are questions that are so complex and individual, and I could just say ditto to what you said. I think for myself, just speaking personally, I would value, I think, the right to end my life if I felt that was the best thing to do for myself and others. It's purely individual. And I can't say that I've given it a great deal of thought, actually. I probably should. But at this moment, yeah. Okay, friends, I think one more then.
Are a really small percentage.
Interesting.
Like, I don't remember what the numbers were exactly, but I think it was like 12 or less percent.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. That just shows the value of having the freedom to go through a whole contemplative inquiry and come out with one's true kind of sense of things.
I'm a chaplain in hospice care, and I've worked in both of these states. And I would just put myself out there if anyone wanted to talk about these issues in greater detail.
Thank you.
One point of view.